netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to the FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. In this ep, ILM VFX supervisor Chad Wiebe and animation supervisor Lee McNair discuss their work on Thunderbolts, focusing on the creation of the Void character, as well as the film's major VFX sequences. The guys talk about how deceptively complex the look of Void was, even though it appears as kind of a simple silhouette. A ton of work went into rendering subtle lighting, maintaining performance fidelity, and making sure that no unintended details could be revealed even when the footage was altered by fans online. They also talk about the challenges of the large-scale sequences I mentioned, including environments, the penthouse fight, and the shadows overtaking New York. So let's go ahead and cross the discussion now.
So Chad and Lee, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
You bet. Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
Chad, when did you guys first get involved with the film?
The original dev started all the way back in May of 2023, and that was preliminary work on the look for the Void. So just basically establishing what the Void look would be, how far into the comic book world we wanted to sort of delve, and just really kind of figuring out what that look, what Jake Schreier sort of wanted to do with the Void. So that went on for a few months until the writer's strike happened. And then, as you know, everything sort of went on hiatus for a little while. And then it resumed back in February of 2024. We started doing previs. That went all the way through to the shoot, which happened in March of 2024 through May of 2024.
So I want to talk about the Void right out of the gate, because I actually find it to be like a really interesting problem. In many respects, it appears to a novice, I think, to be quite simple, like it's just a black outline kind of to them. To me, I was looking at it going, well, hang on, this doesn't look like you've just got a holdout, Matt. This doesn't. But then by the same token, it's like the eyes are kind of there, but there are some hints of form, but obviously not much at all. And I'm thinking, this is like way more complicated than it appears. And I hope I'm right in saying that, but it just didn't seem like this was a slam dunk. It felt like, actually, this is kind of a odd problem to not make it look like it's a bad comp, if you know what I mean.
That was kind of the key. It in itself is a simplistic sort of look, but the amount of energy expended into the look of Void was pretty considerable. So, like I said, we started devving that back in 2023, and I wouldn't be lying if I said some of the final shots that we actually finalized for the film were Void shots as well. So there's a lot of nuances in the simplicity, and I think one of the things that Jake Morrison really did want to stress is that it couldn't just look like we were doing a comp treatment over top of a plate. So even though there isn't a lot of visible components to it, there are a ton of details in the nuances. So each time we saw the Void, we did render a digital version of the Void. We used that for additional lighting passes. We used it for relighting or redirecting where we wanted some of the highlights, and really took a fine-tooth comb to some of the nuances that you do see in there. And all of those details, the amount that you see, the amount that you don't see, it went through numerous kind of changes and rounds and different iterations just to kind of really hone in on what that should be. So there's always a fine line between, do we want to see enough of Lewis's performance? Do we want to, maintain as much of that performance as we can? Because obviously we want to, keep as true to the actor's, amazing performance as we can. But at the same time, you want to kind of have that that mystery and that mystique with the character, where you just kind of get this creepy, otherworldly kind of shadow look. And so that was a very extensive, road to kind of go down and sort of figure out what that look should be. And I think one of the really sort of key things that Jake Morrison had sort of come up with was basically, once we sort of established how much detail we wanted to see, how much of the lighting information, little highlights we'd want to see, the last thing that we would have to sort of ensure with any shot that went out the door is that any shadow where we didn't want information to be visible, we had to make sure that all those blacks were basically clamped. So if someone was viewing it on a monitor that was uncalibrated, or if someone decided that they wanted to gam up a shot, which, trust me, the first trailer that went out, people were cranking around the values for it, we had to make sure that they weren't able to reveal any additional information within that character that we didn't want them to see. So it was very specifically, those highlights were very specifically placed. The details that you see were very intentional, and all the other areas that you don't see any information, that was also a very intentional aspect of it.
I was lucky enough to see it at the premiere in IMAX. So in terms mm-hmm. of color projection quality, it's like the blacks were black. It was really good. I actually saw it again at a local Cinemaplex, and it was disappointingly average projection, as in, you know, just normal kind of stuff. So I was so glad I'd seen the IMAX one, because obviously people are recommended to see the IMAX, not least of which because it's just a big, fun kind of format. But actually, I don't know if you agree, but this is a film where your black point has like never been more critical. Like getting that the quality of the experience right is just a really interesting aspect.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, we really did want everyone to go see it on IMAX just so you can see it in its full glory. But on the opposite end of that spectrum, we also know that people are going to be watching it on YouTube and, you know, on their laptops and on their phones. So you kind of have to think about it from both aspects. So, you know, you have the one environment, which is very controlled. You're projecting the image exactly as you want people to see it. But then on the flip side, as soon as that ends up on a digital platform, you have no control over what people do with it or how they view it. And like I said, the first trailer that came out, there's a lot of, film YouTube channels that just kind of dissect things frame by frame. And the first thing they did is they cranked all those values, and they're trying to see like, what are the nuances within the void? And, you know, can we see any of this, expression, and how is emoting and all that kind of stuff? So it was definitely a moment where, you know, I breathed a sigh of relief as soon as I saw that everything that we'd sort of planned for and everything that we had built into it as a safeguard all kind of worked flawlessly, even on YouTube.
Lee, where did the animation department fit in on this?
Yeah, we started pretty early days as well, because, in taking everything from the boards, from the ideas that they had of where they wanted to go with this, we were doing the pre-flight early on to see how we were going to actually achieve these shots on the day. And then on top of that, we were doing pre-flight supervisor, Kyle Winkleman, and myself, we were putting motion capture suits and trying different things and what was going to work and what those cameras would need to do and how that's all going to fit in with the action they were trying to do with the boards and the previs that they had. So we started on very, very early days and just tried to just keep exploring. Our stuff with the void, for example, wasn't as complex and complicated as it was with the back end team and stuff to get all those correct black points and stuff. We were just kind of charged with making it look as, sinister and dominating and everything as he was. It was just back to just simple, like principal animation of silhouettes and stuff, because he is a silhouette.
I was going to pick up on that, because if you were a traditional animator back in the day, like the silhouette was the thing that non-animators don't focus on, and animators really read like the silhouette of a pose, everything else, which is of course all the audience was primarily going on.
No, and you're very right. And the other thing that kind of made it kind of complicated with some of his void stuff, but it actually kind of made it look a little cooler, I thought too, was his cape. His cape was something that we needed to figure out throughout this whole movie. When he is the void. So when he's in those poses, how do you make that read when a bunch of it's getting silhouetted out by the cape? So then where to make that kind of just a little bit of wind to kind of breathe it by a bit so you can read things a little easier. Even right to doing all his super speed and stuff. When we are doing the only times we were kind of going into that superhero realm, a lot of the times we were trying to keep everything as best we could into a realm of reality is where Jake Schreier, Jake Morrison wanted to stay, wanted to have this movie a lot more grounded than previous Marvel pictures. So, so I guess a lot of the good things we did probably weren't really seen much.
But you say that, but But the flip side is, right, like, I mean, I just imagine spitballing this, like, if you just had the cape falling down and you had a silhouette, it'd look like he was in a dress. I mean, that's what it would look like, right? It's the same silhouette. So, and at no point did it look like that. At no point did it look silly. I only got to that because we were discussing it after the film. And I was thinking, yeah, like the cape just screws with everything you want in terms of posture and, you know, sort of the masculinity of his like stance.
Oh, yeah, you're not wrong at all. And, you know, and having like a lower camera looking up at him at a distance and stuff. There are so many times where he was smaller within camera space. And that still had to read, you know, to, as a quick shot. So, yeah, it did take a bit of finessing back and forth with the whole teams.
Ted, can I ask you a question? Was there a rule, sort of like a rules like you came up with? Like, I mean, does he cast a shadow? Does he have negative light effects and that he sucks light out of the shot? Like, was there sort of like a, did you have like a rule book? And was that the same from the start or did that develop over time if there was such a sort of principles?
Well, I mean, we did explore a lot of those themes. You know, when we were doing some of the early dev work for the Void look, you know, there were a bunch of tests that we were doing just for like, how does the shadow project or how do the people void when they get voided? It all kind of started with Sentry and with the Void though, because that was kind of our main original task for sort of devving the look of him as well as the shadows. But all those ideas were kind of thrown out there. Like, does he just kind of suck in light from everything around him? Does he pull the shadows off of objects around him? Does he project shadows onto people? Does that shadow come from, you know, his perspective or viewpoint, or does it come from the camera's perspective or viewpoint? We even went through some phases where we were doing like a flash when he voids people that are on the street. And what it all basically funneled back down to was just simplicity and not overdoing it and not needing to sort of like build this super elaborate effect that was just overly gratuitous. You know, the whole idea was that it was cool in its simplicity. The sound cues really helped, you know, the voice treatment that they did for Lewis really helped. And just the shock factor of it helped, you know, especially when the first time you see people voiding, like the little girl, for example, the first time I actually saw that with audio and sound, I was like, the room just went silent because everyone was just so shocked because it was such a happy moment that just then turned dark, you know? So
before we get to the voiding of the people, when Sentry as the sort of the black void, I mean, Contact, if you go from animation to comp for a second, like the first thing that comp does, if animation wants to get a silhouette right, comp wants to put contact like between them by having shadows, by having, you know, contact lighting, like just having things to make it sit in the scene. And again, you seemed that was sort of like you were taking some of those tools away from the comp team to sell it. Because I'm thinking like when he's contextualized in an environment, you know, how you would contextualize a character is normally things like light wrap and all those sort of things that just didn't seem valid in this context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly it. And it was a very fine line between going overly graphic and simplistic because, you know, we did sort of tread down that graphic novel comic book look. And we really did sort of, you know, walk on that kind of razor's edge between, you know, black levels that are too black, you know, a lack of light wrap that makes the silhouette just too stark against a very bright background. You know, Jake Morrison was very vocal about wanting to make sure that when we do have void in front of a sky, it didn't look like an ARB comp. So all those tools that you would typically use to do the depth queuing, to do the layering, to the Atmos, we had to do with a very, very delicate touch because it was always a very fine line. Jake Schreier really did want to convey this idea that the shadows and void were kind of not supernatural, but not ordinary shadows. So, you know, black levels still needed to stay within, you know, an acceptable range for a comp, but the blacks of void would almost always be like the darkest thing on the frame. So, you know, we'd be careful not to delve into like illegal values or anything like that. But the whole idea was that he should always look a little bit different than a normal shadow would look, or a little bit denser or darker than a normal shadow would look. And I think in doing that, again, you just kind of put him in a bit of a different realm than everything else in the plate and in the shot. So it, again, it just kind of built on that character that, again, with all the simplicity that you kind of see visually, there's so many little nuances that all sort of like came together for that look.
And I cut you off before you were starting to talk about avoiding the normal people, like the little girl. Just on that for a second, there were two things that struck me, and actually a colleague of mine came up with this, so it's not even an original idea of mine, but the first is that you had to balance what was happening with what the audience is incredibly familiar with within the snap. And so ironically, the term snap implies something fast, but in that case, it was a slow, you know, sort of almost going to dust kind of effect. Here, it felt like you were doing it in one frame. It felt snappy for that.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the second thing I was going to say is the reference, it was haunting and it was like very, I think, like just a really effective on-screen cinematic effect. But as I said, a friend pointed out that it really had reminiscence of the atomic shadows from the original Atomic Blasts, where they found that there was shading on the stone of where someone had been sitting and stuff. I was wondering, was that a reference at all? Or
it was, yeah. And, you know, we use that as a reference point, you know, in addition to a whole bunch of other things. But that was definitely something that, you know, obviously evokes a lot of emotion. And that was kind of the, you know, the idea behind this as well, is that we wanted it to evoke emotion. So that was one of the, you know, reference points that we sort of built off of. And then from there, we went through a whole, you know, round of different aspects with that. Like, you know, again, what do we see inside the shadows? How much detail do we see? Should it feel like it's a soot or a particulate, or should it just feel like a shadow? We went a few rounds with showing, you know, different kind of human components within those shadows. I think I had an idea at one point to, it might be kind of cool to see those shadows continue to move for a few frames before it finally ground to a halt. Yeah, that idea didn't go anywhere. But, you know, again, just exploring different ways to make these things creepy and sort of like a little bit different than what you might expect to see.
Because the effect didn't give the audience any sense that they weren't dead, which they weren't, right? I mean, the main characters come back and everything else, but from an audience point of view, when you're watching it, you're thinking those people have been killed, right? And and it cleverly, without blood and guts, so it seemed like a plausible kill in a Marvel space, if that made sense. I mean, that's what you want, right? You want the audience to be misdirected appropriately, if that makes sense.
I think so. And, you know, again, I think it was, you know, again, just from my own personal experience, I don't want to put words in anyone else's mouth, but I just feel like that was part of the shock factor and the impact of the event, you know, more than anything. I think, you know, you have films like Endgame, where you have these long drawn out moments where people just kind of dissolve into ash, and it's very emotional and you're tugging on heartstrings, but this is just different because it's so quick and it's so impactful and it's so abrupt that you're just kind of taken aback by it, which I thought was
just lethal.
It's kind of brilliant. Yeah. And so, you know, circling back to the one frame thing, you're very right. At some point it was like 1.5 frames and then it went to 3 frames, and it's really amazing how many things you can pack into a couple of frames and how creative you can be when it's just so limited to what you can do as well. You know, again, I think I personally pushed for more frames with both Jake Morrison and Jake Schreier, and I got to give Jake Schreier credit because he stuck to his guns. He's like, no, it needs to be like a frame, maybe a frame and a half. I'll let you show me 3 frames, but you know, I might not like it. And that's basically what ended up happening. You know, I kept trying to push just a couple more frames, because that's, you know, that's kind of what, the nature of what I do wants me to just kind of push the look of it and add more complexity and all these different things. But yeah, at the end of the day, like Jake Schreier had it, you know, he was very steadfast in his direction for it, and I think it paid off because it was a very cool moment that just kind of had people wondering more about it, you know.
So the companion effect is the blackening of the city, the darkening of the city. Yeah. And again, I guess Lee, the question is like, where did that sit in terms of like who solved that problem from ILM? Because you could think it was a 2D effect, but in no way would it have worked as a 2D effect because of the geography, the vertical geography, like the physicality of it all. How did it fall inside ILM?
Well, as far as like the animation purview was, like that was all of it was Chad and the Gen team, the comp team, and us as well. What we did to help was to find out what those cameras were going to look like, how they're going to move, whereabouts we needed to be. Jake Schreier is from New York and has a very good extensive knowledge of the area and stuff, and knew where he wanted to shoot, what he wanted to see, how it was going to expand. So that's how we kind of helped out on that side, was doing the cameras, doing the aerials, getting that kind of feel. And then how fast do these kind of shadows take over? We just did some simple like lighting tests and stuff like that within Maya and everything, and was just seeing how fast it would creep up the buildings, how fast it would expand, just to get the kind of overall feel and the vibe that Jake Schreier was looking for, and then handed it off to the rest of the team to do all their magic.
And was it, I can put this oddly, was it kind of mathematically correct to if you'd actually had a shadow passing over New York, or was it sort of dramatically correct? Because it worked visually for the audience. I'm just wondering like how much was it what I would happen, or how much I would expect would happen, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, we tried to keep both. It as... Yeah. Go ahead, Lee.
No, I was going to say, I think it's both, but like what you can probably speak better to it than I could, Chad.
Yeah, I mean, all the shadows and in fact, like all the city extensions that we did, everything was built in 3D. We didn't have any DMPs. We didn't do any 2D map paintings for the background, except for obviously, you know, there were some shots where we started with plates and then we sort of replaced areas that we needed to have shadows crawling over. But everything was done with proper 3D shadows. We, again, in terms of those shadows, we always tried to start from a place of realism. So we would start with actual proper lighting, project shadows. A lot of times we would actually start with a few silhouettes of characters that would then basically grow and form into these larger shadow masses that would then start to kind of creep up the buildings and stuff. So making sure that the fall off and the penumbra of the shadows was correct, and they crawled over the buildings in a very three-dimensional way, which meant that we had to have a lot of detail on those buildings and those assets. We definitely didn't ever want it to look like it was just a 2D rotor shape. So making sure that we did have all that geo in there for everything. And, you know, for all the street level shots, you know, we had extensive amounts of LiDAR that we used, and then we built everything out from there. So every building that we saw shadows crawling over, both from the street level shots and from the bigger sort of city shots, the overviews, all had three-dimensional geometry that allowed the shadows to kind of crawl up them in a 3D way, as opposed to just kind of a wipe or a linear reveal.
What were you guys rendering all that 3D in, just out of interest? Like, what renderer do you use?
Geez, good question. So I believe the majority of the city stuff is rendered in V-Ray, because that's where our environment uses.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, it has to look
we,
very
we use a few different renderers, yeah. We kind of have like two different approaches for our environment stuff. We either use V-Ray, which is what we use on that project. My current project, we're using Houdini, because we sort of go back and forth depending on the amount of effects-based environment work we need to do.
So switching to the penthouse, that must have been fun for the animation team, Lee, the penthouse fight sequence. Again, how much was that something that evolved? How much was it tightly kind of storyboarded or prevised?
Yeah, no, you're right. It was a blast. It was, there was a lot to figure out in that sequence. It did come. We did have previs done by our team in Sydney, and we took that in and plussed that out further to do like a post-viz to see like, okay, how do we now, we've got the idea of what needs to happen. How do we actually shoot this practically? And where are we going to be taking things over? Like our most complicated portion of that fight was the one section we lovingly called the Oneer, where it is where everyone kind of just takes on Sentry one at a time, and the MoCo camera just keeps on going around the penthouse to explain more of the fight. Of how we were going to achieve all of that. Well, like where to do the takeovers from the actor coming in to do their motion to then they needed to be in this superpower moment or thrown around or put into the ceiling, or when do those moments need to happen? There was lots of heavy lifting in that. There was like, it literally took a village to get that shot done, of everyone and all their expertise across every discipline, to bring like all the things like, oh, I did that shot and I did this part of this shot back in this movie here. I think I have an idea how to fix this and how to do that. So it was awesome to have everyone come together to kind of figure out every little nuance of that. It
seems at a fundamental level, you have an inherent staging problem that many films have tackled over the years, which is you've got one person, multiple people are attacking. And so the question is, what are the people that are not currently throwing the punches doing that they're not engaging, if you know what I mean? Like, so you have to stage it so the audience doesn't say, why are four of them hanging back while one person is taking the hit? And sometimes like that can be really odd. I mean, it wasn't here, right? But it, so there's that. So it's a camera staging problem. And then, of course, you've got the sort of need to read action when inherently the action is incredibly fast and could be incredibly disorientating to the audience, especially as you've now got superhero type coming and going effects. So, I can't even imagine how you'd start the choreography on that. But then again, as you say, integrating that so that you've still got the authenticity of the live action actors would be really hard, I imagine.
Yeah, and you're very right. It all kind of played together as well. Like it was there's benefits and like there's advantages and disadvantages of having that MoCo camera, of it all being planned out, how it's going to work. Because then you're right that then, you know, if someone gets thrown off camera, you know that the camera operator is not going to come too far around and expose what just happened way back there. We don't get that far around and then come back around this way. So you're never really guessing where that character went or what they're doing, how they're getting up, you know, all those kind of things.
I think that's the beauty of doing pre-viz and tech viz as well, because you can kind of figure all that stuff out. And one of the challenges too is because we're using like a techno dolly, we sort of had schematics of the penthouse, layout, so that we had the dimensions of the space, and we had to kind of figure out like where can you actually put a techno dolly that can actually achieve all these camera moves without needing to, either have people crossing over the track or tripping over the track or, getting thrown through the camera rig or all these different things. So what we ended up doing is break it into three different sections where we could actually move the crane around. But that was really something that required some pretty specific tech viz and pre-viz just so we could really figure all that out. Because there was a lot of complexities, and the last thing you want to do is be there on the day and then realize their shot that you planned out in pre-viz, you can't actually physically, fit your camera rig. And then, it's kind of like, now what? So everything did have to be really well planned out. Everything had to be very well rehearsed. And, our pre-viz team did a phenomenal job getting all that stuff set up. So on the day we did have a lot of bigger questions answered, a lot of logistical things answered, and that made it go that much more smoother.
Just on that logistical aspect, the thing that struck me also is there are a lot of props that get thrown around, like the bar. Yeah. And so if the bar gets destroyed, it's not there if you do a second take, unless you rebuild the bar each time. And so there would be a tendency, I'd say, to say, look, we just had to put this in digitally because, quite frankly, we can't kind of reset these things constantly. Or if you did, you've got this problem of like, well, I've changed the fundamental set as I'm shooting it. So how much of the stuff around them was digital? How much was that prac?
Well, I mean, we tried to get everything practically. So we did actually do a bar pull. I think we got two versions of it. Again, just the challenges of having like, massive camera rigs and a techno dolly, inches away from where you want to practically pull a bar creates some challenges as well, which, again, planning is kind of everything when it comes to that kind of stuff. But, we had David Harbour on wires. We had the bar pull. Again, the good thing with MoCo is that you can capture all that stuff in different passes. So you're not having to capture it all at the same time. So we got David in one take, then we did the bar pull in another take. We had Lewis doing his action while holding on to one of the other characters as a separate take as well. So in total, there was about three different sections that we shot, three different camera moves that we sort of recorded and then played back for all the different passes that we had to get. So that allowed us to kind of bring in different actors, swap out different actors, reposition them for things like century speed, get all the stunt passes with people on wires. There's a ton of passes and different elements that we shot. So again, it's great because you get just so much data that you get to work with and put back together. But there's also challenges when you start putting all that stuff together and you have to basically stitch together any gaps with digi doubles or, CG props or things of that nature. And you start to realize, this looks good as a standalone, but as part of the bigger picture, is it reading fast enough? Or, is the action pacing as quickly as we want it to? And at the end of the day, we found that some areas needed to be sped up, some areas needed a little bit more action. So I think that's where, both Jake Schreier and Jake Morrison were very, good at sort of like realizing what was working in camera, trying to keep as much of that as we could, but also understanding that in some instances you might need to do a performance enhancement or a digi double takeover because you need to keep that action flowing and you need to speed things up and keep it exciting and action packed. So
did you just give up on green screen and figure, hey, we just roto stuff because green screen's going to create too many changes in lighting for your multiple passes?
So we actually used a translite background in the Pinto. So that was based on some photogrammetry of the New York City skyline. And that was always intended to potentially give us in camera final for, shots where the background might be completely out of focus or at least give us something that gave us good reflections or, good interactive lighting. And to that extent, it was amazing. It was so much better than having to, de-spill actors and then relight them. And you always kind of get that stagey look you do the best you can to not have that blue screen sort of stagey look. So I think from that perspective, it's great. And I've said a few times, I will always opt for a little bit more extraction work than, a ton more work trying to get the actors sitting into a digital environment.
Yeah, I can imagine. So Lee, when you were doing the digi doubles, how much did you have to bother with facial type animation and matching? Or was it really body? Because if you're doing a takeover and you're suddenly hitting motion blur, you're not going to really read a face where you would read what the body is doing. Or did you need to do both?
Yeah, we did a bit of both. We did match up to facial performances. Didn't dive too much into any acting and stuff, but we did have all the faces that we needed, all the facial shapes that we needed to adjust to blend from the CG character into the actor. And it was, I know Chad is just as scared as I was at some of the times at some of the blends that we needed to do that weren't actually allowed to happen during a blur moment. It was pretty much in screen and there was no hiding from it. So we had a lot of difficult work ahead of us to get that all cleaned up and get that seamless and moving well, especially in having them so grounded in reality. There wasn't a lot of moments to do the big super stuff aside from the big motions. There was a lot of takeovers before that would even happen or even after that would happen. Because we needed to make sure that we're going right back into the character and right back into the character's performance. Jake Schreier really wanted to see all the emotion coming through. They wanted to see the actors and stuff. So there was quite a tight balancing act to do between the references we had, the shape libraries we used, motion capture, like everything, in order to try to just seamlessly get it back onto where it needed to be.
So when you're setting something like this up, I presume you didn't have like final turnover when you're doing the scanning of the actor. So you'd probably want to have a bit up your sleeve and err on the side of getting a bit better quality scanning in case you needed it. But like, what is the sort of default pipeline for you guys now? Is it like a light stage Medusa kind of thing, or have you moved beyond that?
Everything that we got on this show was from Clear Angle. So they have their Dorothy set up now, which gives you a lot of really great data. We also use Satellite Lab to give us a bunch of lighting reference and performance reference as well. So, I mean, that was one thing that was really set up well on the show. Jake Morrison made sure to get, you know, copious amounts of scan data and reference material and, you know, everything that you can kind of ask for in order to make sure you can replicate the characters.
Yeah, I guess you're helped by the fact that you can get such good resolution from any camera. I mean, Clearlight does really good work, but I mean, you know, in the old days, like if the head was far enough, well, you didn't get skin poor texture, right? Because you weren't like shooting on a high enough sensors, but you've got that detail. Because I mean, I certainly couldn't pick any passes between the real actors and the digital, and I was looking for it. So, you know, it's clearly worked really well.
Oh, brilliant.
Well, that is good to hear. I mean, it's always the scariest part. I've done a number of shows in the past where you have to do digi-double hookups and, you know, stitching multiple shots together and all that kind of stuff. And as Lee was mentioning, you always really want to kind of rely on action moments and motion blur and, you know, frames where actors are moving in order to sort of hide the blend points. But yeah, in this film, there's a lot of full frontal, you know, non-blurred transitions that we had to do. So the fact that they weren't blatantly obvious is a really good thing. But you know, our team worked really hard and painstakingly went frame by frame to make sure that everything was lined up and there's no discrepancies.
Yeah, and the actors needed to convey during that fight more than just, hey, I'm punching this guy, but the frustration of not being able to achieve stuff and a kind of a transition through that fight. Like there's an arc from, hey, we're going to beat the crap out of this guy to, hey, he's going to beat the crap out of us and we're losing and we're very disappointed in that fact. And you don't have a second piece of exposition for that. That's happening. This acting is happening during your fight sequence.
Yeah. I mean, that was something that we kind of went back and forth on too, especially for Sentry. There was a lot of back and forth, at least initially, in terms of like what his sort of skill level and confidence level should be, because obviously as the character developed in the movie, you kind of see multiple sides of him. You see his kind of confident, cocky side, and you see his sort of insecure, kind of more manic side. And I guess, you know, seeing Sentry for the first time as he descends the stairs into the penthouse and as he sort of gets into his first official fight, you know, a lot of the discussions around that were kind of trying to figure out like what is his confidence level? Does he understand what his powers are? You know, does he have the confidence to kind of use them? And you know, that kind of went a few rounds just to kind of figure out what the proper, you know, attitude for Sentry was when he started you know, fighting the rest of the Thunderbolts.
Just a hunch, this may be completely erroneous, but did you have to do any, this is not from it looking bad, but did you have to do anything with his hair? Because it seemed to me like he's moving around and he always looked good.
I mean, we had to match it for our digi double. But in terms of like replacement for any plate stuff, no, I mean, he
hair and makeup just used lots of hairspray, right?
Hair and makeup. Yeah. And you know, obviously we had to have a number of grooms, that we'd sort of use for our starting point for our Sims, because obviously he comes in the stairs and he hasn't started fighting yet. So his hair is kind of perfect. And then as the fight progresses, he gets a little bit more disheveled. So we had to kind of, you know, just kind of tweak various shot-based grooms to kind of figure out like what the starting point is. Because a lot of that stuff is kind of hard to sim to sort of get it to a point where it matches. So you can do sculpts on some of the guy curves and things to get it generally in the same realm. But there's also just, you know, some hand grooming that you need to do to get it to match.
Well, I'm so glad that the film has done so well. And, you know, there are lots of, obviously, people that contributed to that success. But clearly you guys carried the day when it came to New York and stuff so well, because both those acting moments that, as I said, we sort of completely understood, as well as those big effects, which, quite frankly, coming up with original things when we've seen New York handled a couple of different ways before, and we've seen people, you know, snapped a few times before, this worked so well, and I'm so glad that it has. The film's a great hoot, and I totally recommend people seeing it in IMAX with very good projection, because they can only then, I think, fully appreciate the quality and the subtlety of some of the stuff you guys pulled off. But thanks so much for taking time to talk to us.
Oh, thank you so much, Mike. It was my pleasure.
Yeah, an absolute pleasure, and thank you very much for saying so. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys, for taking time to chat with us about ILM's work on the film. And in case you missed it, episode number 295 of the VFX show covered Thunderbolts, and Matt, Jason, and Mike discussed the film in detail. You can find that at fxguide.com/the VFX show. Well, that's it for this episode of the FX Podcast. For Mike Seymour, I'm John Montgomery. Thanks for listening.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.